It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay, so I think I have come up with and then forgotten like 7 cold opens today.
Just today.
Yes. So now I have settled on 2. Except one of which isn't going to be cold open because it'll act, you'll see why. It fits better later. So the other one, oh, sorry, I have a notification to record a podcast. And that one is for you, but the first one is for all the listeners. Also for you, but I'm pretty confident in your answer. But as a stand-in for the listeners, I want to ask you, did you ever play the game MASH when you were a kid?
It doesn't sound familiar.
That's what I thought. It's one of those games kids play and you need friends. So I assumed you probably never.
No.
No, this came up recently when we were in Virginia. I don't know where I was, but I came back into a space where there were a bunch of people and they were all laughing and stuff, and they were breaking it to me that Trish, my wife and producer of the podcast, was now going to marry our nephew and was, I forget where they were going to live. They were going to have a really nice car, but they were going to make like no money. It was a whole deal. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm just playing along. I'm like, oh, that, okay, wow. All right, where am I going to be then? What's the... It turned out they had a guest house. And I'm like, can I stay there? Whatever, you know, whatever works. And then my youngest niece, who is, I believe, around 8 or 9 at this point, says, it was just, we were playing MASH. And I was like, oh. And then everyone in the room looked at me and was like, do you know MASH? And I looked at all of them and I'm like, do you not know MASH? It's a thing kids play when they're little at school with their friends. And everyone in the room, which is like near a dozen people, had never heard of it except for me and my youngest niece. And her mom afterwards was like, I thought something about this was familiar. I maybe used to know it, but that was it. Nobody else did. So I bring this up because I want to ask listeners, please go to the blog, themagicaltalkhat.com, or if you're watching this on YouTube, comment on YouTube. Do you know MASH? And did you play MASH? For those of you not familiar, as with our friend William here, it's a very stupid fortune-telling game, essentially. And MASH stands for mansion, apartment, I think shack, and house. And MASH is essentially a game wherein you determine what your life will be like in the future, specifically in terms of who you'll marry, where you'll live, what kind of car you'll have, money. What they're probably, I mean, variations on.
Kids played games like this when I was a kid.
Yes.
I don't think they called it that, but they played games like that.
You would make little lists. So like, what kind of car? And you would list off like 4 types of cars,
sure,
and whatever, and then some form of random number generation. In our day, or where I was, it was who the proctor of the game essentially would start drawing a spiral, and the other person was supposed to, the player was supposed to tell them when to stop, and then we would essentially count the rings and then use that as a
I saw method. Kids do that, but they also had this little paper thing they'd fold up and they'd...
Which is a completely unrelated.
Okay.
That is a different fortune-telling game.
Yeah.
Completely unrelated to
that. But yeah, I saw that the spiral thing be done
lots
of times.
So I'm curious.
As you pointed out, I didn't have any friends, so I just had to see other people do it.
Yeah. I prefer to think like nobody was doing any spirals. It was a Uzumaki thing, and you just would see spirals.
I remember seeing kids do this now that you're describing it.
But none of the other people in the room who came from varying ages and locations, and yet clearly this is a game that persisted from the early 80s to today, from one side of the continental US to the other side. So I found it really fascinating that no one else there knew what the hell we were talking about.
Interesting.
Yeah, but so I am curious in a broader scope. So yeah, let us know in the comments or on the blog. Did you know this game? Did you play it? Where were you and what period of time was it when you would play it? Or maybe your kids played it. Maybe your grandparents played it. I don't know your business. Yeah, let me know, because I'm curious. I want a very, very binding poll that can be used for future statistics. A great sample size. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that actually operates in five dimensions. And it's that fifth one where most of the content is. So those of you living in, you know, the three-dimensional space going through linear time, missing out on it. That's where the good stuff is.
Yep, it's too bad.
We miss out on it, too. So, you know. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 648.
Which this brings me into my second thing, which I want to talk to you about. And I want to say up front, this sounds like something I thought of when I was high. But I promise I did not. This is something I thought of today while I was very much sober.
Okay.
But it's essentially a narrative pitch. I want to know if this is anything. So I really like hyperdimensionality, narratively speaking. Mm-hmm. I always think it's kind of fun. The flatland idea, the fact that like your entire universe can be a minuscule amount of yourself or a thing or whatever, because there are dimensions of which you cannot perceive.
Yeah, I like that too.
Could sentience be divided up dimensionally? Imagine now, we're talking hyperdimensionality here, so we can adjust the numbers to whatever paradigm we want. For the sake of this conversation, I'm going to say we live in four dimensions.
Okay.
Three-dimensional physical space and fourth dimension of time.
Sure.
So, me as me, real easy speculative thing here. Let's say I actually am five-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
And I and no one else here perceive that other dimension. Could my intelligence have an extra dimension that essentially has its own will? Am I speaking gibberish, or is this an idea that could be used? Because I came up with this concept of like, so I'm going around and then I find myself doing things that I don't intend to do. And it eventually comes up that my higher dimensional self, for reasons I was unaware of, is causing me to do other things intentionally, not random, intentionally for a, pardon the pun, higher purpose. Is that a thing? Does that work? Sure. I don't mean, does that work mathematically? Does that work narratively?
I mean, so there are some people who suggest that when you get a dimension that's sort of beyond time, it starts to be difficult to talk about an entity that has intentionality and plans and whatever, because those are all time-bound things.
Yeah.
But the idea that you are just a part of a larger consciousness, and that like one of the things you'll realize when you die is that you were just an appendage on something much bigger that was doing what it was doing, and you thought you were living your life and making choices or whatever, but really the whole course of your life was just because you were the big toe of this much bigger entity that was doing what it was doing, and you were just along for the ride. Yeah, that kind of thing has been speculated, I think.
All right, so what I'm hearing is it is a valid idea that lots of people have already come up with.
I don't know if lots of people, but I mean, it's...
people that hang out with you.
It's an idea that has been in my head before, and I don't think I just thought of it. I think it kind of came from things I absorbed from other places.
That is fun, though. If you think in terms of, let's say, literally our entire universe, when you step back into a higher dimension, is a single entity.
Mm-hmm. Well, if another way to
accept that conceit, then we can start playing with, what if it's not a single entity, but it's like a finite number of different entities? And then you get into things like these people and these planets and these things are this one entity. Sure. And then the other ones. And I suppose then you get into a fun game of cosmology there.
I mean, another way to look at it is that all the versions of you are actually one person. And eventually, when each version of you dies, you become aware of the oneness of all the versions of you. And so you have the memories, not just of your memories, but all your versions' memories. And so really you are this multidimensional being that as a whole is made up of all the individual lives that your 3.5, four dimensional self lives. And
a fascinating philosophical concept that I believe was looked at very seriously in the documentary starring Jet Li called The One. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Well, this is an idea it's an idea where your multidimensional self can be distinct from other multidimensional selves. Because the thing is, when you start asking, well, is there a higher dimensional version of me that I'm just a part of? Then that doesn't have to end, right? That means there might be, you can sort of subscribe to the somewhat Buddhist idea that there is only one thing and everyone's just a part of that one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just don't realize that they are. I mean, that's just an innovation on that very ancient idea.
This question comes from that thing I've talked about before, where I think you and I are very big on not having continuity issues in our narrative, which is not common, and actually is probably a weakness for both of us in terms of having marketable things, because I don't think most people worry to the level that we do. As evidenced by the fact that every fucking TV show and movie in the world has all sorts of plot holes in it that I cannot stop staring at.
And nobody cares.
But it means that when I have a cool idea, like, yeah, nobody cares except you and I. And it means when I have a cool idea like this, I have to pause and I'm like, okay, is this made up dookie nonsense? Because I would hate to turn this into something and then later somebody be like, you know what? That's made up dookie nonsense. Because there are great sci-fi stories and movies out there, even ones that I've really enjoyed, and then years later somebody's like, yeah, but what about, and I'm suddenly like, oh shit, the whole thing is really dumb because of like this one very fundamental, why would they do that? It's like, oh well, I think a great example of this that I can think of off the top of my head actually is the first time I talked to you about the Hunger Games. Because you were just like, yeah, this isn't how this would work. I don't care if the war's over. People would not be like, okay, I'll just send my children off to die for a TV show.
No.
And I was like, ah. And I have never looked at, not that I was ever a huge Hunger Games fan anyway, but I've never looked at it the same since then. I was like, you know, I have known some parents and some children and some people who, you know, participated in revolutions, and I think you're right. So yeah.
No, I think so. Like one of the story I've been working on myself is like a, you know, deals with multidimensional stuff, and so my premise is going to be that the action takes place in a place that's higher dimension than like you and I experience, but it's like right on the edge of much higher dimensions. And then that causes certain restrictions in how people work. It allows them to do things that would look like magic to you and me, but it doesn't allow them to, you know, they can still have, it still makes sense for them to have like time-bound personalities, and it still makes sense for it to take them a little while to get places, right? They can't just zip over to someplace, or they can, but it would take so much effort and energy that it's worth it just to take their time to get there. But I have found that when I'm thinking about these things for my own storytelling, that if you raise the dimensionality too high, not only does it get almost impossible to really conceptualize it, but you start losing all of the things that make plots in human stories interesting, like time, the passage of time, the normal personalities of people and things like that. You can.
Well, and it's that novel I read years ago, Diaspora, that was all about artificial, essentially digital consciousnesses and that discussed the birth of new ones and all that. And that one dealt a lot with hypergeometrical or hyperdimensional geometry.
Yeah.
And I am glad I read that book. I don't know that I enjoyed that book. I sure as shit don't ever, I never could, but also don't want to write anything like that was dense as hell, where like occasionally you would forget it was a story. Like, so you can definitely go too far. I think this is the right thing right now because everybody's all about independent dimensions right now. We're all about multiverses right now, not higher dimensions, which admittedly the two can go together, but they aren't right now. Everybody's all about there's this version of yourself and this version of yourself, and they're separate, but they're very similar and all that kind of shit.
Well, they do go together because for you to have different universes that you can travel to, you have to go through a higher dimensionality. You have to go basically through the fifth dimension to go from one universe to the other. Doesn't mean you're going to stay in the fifth dimension or do anything there or experience anything there.
No.
But that has to exist or else you can't get from one to the next.
They can't be wholly independent or else you wouldn't have alternate versions.
Right.
And if they aren't wholly independent, then there is some higher dimension by which they are connected.
But you know, the UFO people and the Bigfoot people and all those people who are interested in all that stuff.
Some of my favorite bands out of the 90s.
They're starting to try to conceive of sort of a grand unified theory of all this stuff that's all about multidimensionality. So
that's awesome. I have known a lot of higher, like very intelligent people have worked on grand unified theory for a long time. So I'm pretty confident that the UFO and Sasquatch enthusiasts.
Well, so what the upshot of it is, you know, you have a lot of the conventional view for a lot of UFO people is that, oh, a lot of these things you read in ancient literature of godlike and supernatural things, that's actually aliens. But what the multidimensional view suggests is, well, no, it could be that what people are seeing now are actually fairies and gods. This is just how they see them. So this idea that UFO phenomena is one thing and people back then didn't understand it and they just explained it the best they could, the multidimensional people are saying, oh, it's one thing, but it's not UFOs either. Every generation that experiences these interdimensional phenomena are conceptualizing it how it makes sense to us, but it's never what we're conceiving of. It's always this multidimensional thing that we can't conceive of any other way except by the narratives that we tell.
I think I may know what seed put this in my head recently. So Jordan Breeding, who does the series recap videos that I put out his new one for the month, and it's the Indiana Jones movies.
Hmm.
And in having him recap Crystal Skull, which I saw at the time, and is one of the few movies that prior in recent years, this is more common, but back in the day, me going to see a movie in the theater, I almost always walked out of the theater thinking it was at least okay.
Right.
Crystal Skull was one of the few that I walked out and I was like, yeah, no, that was bad. But in watching the recap recently, I had forgotten the level to which at the climax of the film, they try and explain the aliens and stuff, and it makes no goddamn sense. Anyway, for those of you just joining us, we have a hat, obviously. It's magic in that it has its own email address. TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com. People used to write into that, TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com, with little, whatever they felt like. And we, the hat would forward them to us, and we would read them and talk about them. And that was pretty much the entire premise of the show. So, but I have been learning. In the last episode, I really enjoyed. I mean, I don't know if it was any good, but I never know if it's any good. But I enjoyed it a lot. And I like coming up with, like, I come up with questions for you or whatever. I think that's fun. Actually, one of my cold open ideas that I have just now remembered was I was going to take you through the nuts and bolts of the game Fuck, Marry, Kill that I'm pretty confident you've never played. And I want to discuss that.
I've heard of it, so I've never played it.
I would say overall, maybe I'm happier now that we don't have any. So
okay.
That
we do have one email though from Azure Talent.
I'm sorry. You were really in the moment there. You were acting harder than I realized. I fully thought you missed your cue.
Nope, I didn't.
It was creating dramatic tension. I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you why I got this way. You weren't playing yourself.
Oh.
Because real life William, if I ever expressed happiness about something that you knew to not be the case, you wouldn't be chuckling. You'd feel bad. You'd be like,
I probably would feel bad. Yeah.
Actually,
shoot. You're right. I didn't really nail that.
I don't know what character you were doing there, but
I don't either.
So if any of you ever think that we pre-plan any of this, there's your proof that we don't, because we did that one. That's okay. What it looks like when we pre-plan. So
I don't know. I think we've done it at least one other time.
Don't tell him. The times we did it good will look seamless and perfectly improvised. Don't just... Anyway. Oh, also, it's not Thursday.
No.
It's Monday. We are recording it 3 days early. Fun fact, because I had plans on Thursday. And so that didn't work. But extra fun fact, those plans got canceled last night. But I decided, fuck it, let's stick with this. So I didn't even let William go. My Thursday will just be very open this week. So that'll be nice. It's so rare that I get a Thursday without having to fucking deal with you. So take it. All right. So how is your, I guess, half week? I don't know. How's it been?
Well, I didn't go to the state fair. You know, I looked at our old...
Yes, I forgot to talk about that last time. We literally recorded last time on the first day of the state fair, and I knew that, and I meant to talk about it, and I forgot.
No, we didn't go. For a variety of reasons, it's not going to happen this year. I tried to look back...
That's a shame.
I tried to look back through our old... Like, I could find the ones that should have been after I went to the fair, and sometimes you say, oh... William talks about going to the fair, and sometimes you don't, but that doesn't mean I didn't talk about it. It just means you didn't mention it. But I didn't
find it interesting enough to remember.
Yeah. But I mean, there have been other times I haven't been able to go, but I was curious. Well, you know, in the last 12 years, I should be able to figure out years I went, years I didn't, but I didn't like go into the actual shows to find out if I talked about it, but we're not going this year, unfortunately. But I mean, that happens sometimes. It's hard, you know, it's 100 miles away.
I was about to say, it feels like it's been more common in recent years, but then I remembered COVID, so never mind.
I mean, we did go last year, so that was fine. But I mean, I think the year before, aside from COVID, I got news about my surgery in July, and then a whole bunch of stuff kind of had to happen before that. And it, you know, we just didn't have the bandwidth or whatever to do that. So, but that's fine. I mean, well, you know, it's, that's how life works. We do love going to the fair, and I do miss it when we can't go. And this is my fair hat, you know, the buttercup. Mm-hmm. The buttercup. but we did see Guardians of the Galaxy. I remembered.
Ah,
mention.
Well, wait, did you see the holiday special first?
No. And I still haven't seen it. And maybe we will.
It's better than at least some of the Guardians movies. But anyway.
Okay. Well, we kind of watched it on a whim, you know, so it wasn't like, it's long. So we weren't going to watch it something else with it. I would say I had a similar response that you had. And if I were to be just objective and intellectually honest about it, I'd say it was a perfectly fine film. I didn't really get into it that much. It didn't really do anything for me personally. I got what you were saying about the tone. It's like going from here to there. Because when it was serious, it was like really.
Let's put this out there. This maybe qualifies as a partially spoiler, but it's not that kind of movie. Arguably the movie's central plot is all about Rocket Raccoon. And in the process, we learn a lot about his history. So the movie goes from fun, goofy Guardians shit like you're used to, and then switches over to just so much animal cruelty. Just
and dark.
Just tons of real. Yeah, not like I'm not being all, you know, technically that qualifies as. And I'm like, no, intentionally, very much like meant to be horrible, meant to be animal cruelty.
Graphically portrayed, really. I mean, it.
A lot.
Yeah. There's no way to get through those scenes without really, you know, unless you're totally heartless, feeling really awful. And then, oh, now we're going to joke around a little bit. And it just feels it's a little too much.
Honestly, a lot of movies like this have some of that. It's just real noticeable here.
Yeah.
that sort of tonal whiplash is not uncommon in the MCU entirely. And in a lot of like action movies and things.
But like I said, if I'm objective about it, it's like, it's perfectly fine. I mean, I didn't think there was anything technically wrong with it. It just wasn't my cup of tea. But it felt long.
How'd the soundtrack go for you?
Did you have a similar
thing to what I had?
Yeah, I noticed. Or,
I mean, I might have put that in your head, so that might not be fair.
Possible. It's possible, but I think I also would have noticed here's the next song in the soundtrack. Here's the next.
It's,
I mean,
all
it's like
good music. Don't get me wrong. I might want to get the soundtrack. But
it just seemed... Yeah, it really took you out of it. Like they were really trying hard to make you hear a bunch of cool songs. And I didn't mind it going kind of beyond the time frame that you're used to. But yeah, as soon as a song started, sometimes I thought, well, another problem with it wasn't just that it was obvious they were trying to put on all their favorite songs in, basically. But it didn't always seem to fit either. Like they felt shoehorned in a little bit. Like they didn't fit.
I would agree with that.
But again, did it overall make it like a poorly made film or put together or poorly acted or anything? No, I think it was, you know, I didn't like the second one myself personally. I didn't think it was as strong. The second was as strong as a film as the first one, but I didn't get the sense that this was a weak effort. It just didn't resonate with me. So
I find this interesting, and actually it's starting to be a pattern. So I haven't rewatched any of them, so it's hard to say, but Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is one of those that for the most part I didn't hear about people not liking it much at the time, but now I hear it quite often from people. And the more I think about it, that's also kind of what happened with Iron Man 2. And even ones that I felt strong, like the second Thor movie, it didn't get a lot of shit when it first came out. I hated it, but it didn't get a lot of crap. But now people talk about it like, yeah, oh, oof, it was terrible. Like the second movies which makes me nervous for Wakanda Forever. Although, again, I wasn't that into Wakanda Forever. So, yeah, so I think this might be a thing.
Well, overall, again, even though I didn't really like the second movie very much. If now that I can think of it as a trilogy, I think it's a pretty respectable trilogy. I mean, you know, there are a lot worse trilogies out there.
I would say the Guardians movies are still some of my favorite MCU films.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't think I'd ever like purchase them and like watch all three of them together or something. But if someone was over at my house and they wanted to do that, I think I could enjoy really all of them, even the second one, even though, like I said, I didn't like it very much. But yeah, as a part of a trilogy, as part of a journey from the beginning to the end, I think I could do that. I think that would be fine. Now, like, if I watch Indiana Jones movies, I won't watch anything except Raiders and
Last Crusade.
Like, yeah. I have tried to watch Temple of Doom many times. It's just terrible. I mean, I to me, it's every bit as bad as the last two Indiana Jones movies, and I won't watch them either. So it's too bad. But
I didn't see the second one for a long time and kind of wanted to, but I think also I was young enough. I think maybe I thought it would be a little scary. I don't know. And then I got older and realized, oh no, it just sounds awful. And then as time got on, I was like, yeah, no, it's definitely awful. And there are people who love it in a very nostalgic way. Oh, if you are at the right age and temperament of humor when it came out, it was awesome for you. Weirdly, if you were probably a boy of about the age I was when it came out, perfect. I didn't happen to see it. But then again, there were a lot of things that boys my age liked that I didn't like. But it's some garbage. And also, like, in a whole series that is incredibly culturally problematic, like, oh, yeah, from jump, Temple of Doom is the worst offender by a healthy margin.
I mean, I didn't like it. I saw it in the theater when it came out, didn't like it.
Yeah.
And part of it was they made Indiana Jones. So in the second movie, they change his character a little bit from the first movie, where he's kind of an opportunist and he's like all about the money and stuff.
In the second movie is technically a prequel.
I think that's true. Yes.
No, it is. Trust me. I've just watched twice the full recap of all five movies on YouTube. It takes place the year before, which is especially funny because the other two leads in that movie are never mentioned again. So they presumably died off screen in between.
But it still doesn't make sense for his character arc or anything, because in Last Crusade, they show him as a young person being concerned about this should be in a museum and all that stuff.
Yep.
And what weird thing did he go through that turned him into a complete mercenary? Nothing. It doesn't make any sense. And the plot doesn't make sense. And it's just perfectly dumb.
I'll tell you what, again, watching these has done for me and made me realize, and you might not like this as much, because I definitely don't think you're going to at least fully agree. Indiana Jones, Nathan Drake, Lara Croft. These are all a particular type of character that I never need to see again, because they are a romanticized version of some colonizing imperialist bullshit. Like, all of those people, apologies to Lara Croft, are awful, are terrible in some very fundamental levels about how they live their life, what they do for a living, and what their goals are. Now, within that, there are subcategories. Like, even if you think that's a cool kind of person, Indiana Jones is a very bad version of that. But that kind of, like, the best version is still some colonizing bullshit. Like, white people going in and ruining indigenous temples and things. And also, a weird theme in all of them, discovering definite proof of the supernatural and not only not telling people, but pretending they don't believe it a year later. In the latest Indiana Jones, which I didn't see because not even because I thought it would be bad, although it sounds like it is, but because I don't need another Indiana Jones. He explicitly says he doesn't believe in magic. The dude literally has drunk from the Holy Grail. The dude has literally used a magic stone to call upon the power of Shiva to set fire on a dude. The dude has literally seen the Ark of the Covenant and watched, well, not watched, but listened to it melt a whole bunch of Nazis. And that's what's funny. Last Crusade, we like it, and we do like it. But I think we like it like we like Star Trek IV. Like, I think nowadays, if you tried to eliminate the nostalgia, you'd be like, he mocks his father for being Christian. Like, and how bullshit that is, even though, again, Ark of the Covenant. Real. Nazi face melting. Like, so yeah. Hot take, Indiana Jones is trash. Lara Croft is trash. Nathan Fillion, still, I love him. And he should have played Nathan Drake. Nathan Drake, trash. All these Tomb Raiders and the various versions. I think that's the best phrase for it. I think Tomb Raider hit the nail on the head for what they are. They're horrible and they're terrible. The end.
Yeah, I mean, they, like you said, they ruin sacred sites to get specific artifacts that they think they are entitled to own, even if to put in a museum. Which museum? The British Museum? You know, it's like, yeah, well, right.
But, and that hits a thing too. Literally no artifact ever even tangentially involved in any of the 5 Indiana Jones movies ever ends up in a museum. None of them.
No.
White.
We've got our best men working on it.
Yes. Top men.
Top men. That's right.
I had forgotten in an action set piece in the 4th one, they fucking knock over the box that has the Ark in it and it just falls out and like nobody does anything. And let's not forget, canonically, Marion Ravenwood, the love of Indy's life, was 14 when they dated.
Yeah, I seem to recall
and
that
he was
mentioned.
An adult. And not canonically, but just interesting behind the scenes, she was 14 when they dated because Steven Spielberg talked George Lucas out of his original plan, which was that she was going to be 11 when they dated.
What?
And again, he was an adult. Yep.
I didn't know that.
Now, to be fair, even George Lucas admitted that was a good call. I mean, good-ish, you know, but yeah. Anyway, we're going to run out of time here. Ask me how my week was.
How was your week?
Weird question.
Pull out your phone and tell me all about it.
Here's what I will say about this week, actually. I have been watching, not on purpose in some cases, too many really good movies recently. And I need to stop. It's too hard on my brain.
You see good movies?
Yes.
Oh.
Crappy movies I don't have to think about. Good movies have me considering all sorts of things and talking about other people with them and all sorts of stuff. And I've done a whole bunch in a row. Yes, thank you. We're podcasting. You can be on me. You can't be on the computer. You're going to hit a button and then ruin everything. Anyway, so we already talked about Gaslight, which was really, really good. Since then, I have seen 3 more really good movies. And it was such a weight on my brain that last night I rewatched Babysitter Massacre, which is a terrible movie that I don't recommend to anyone, even people who like terrible movies. It's not a so bad it's good. It's just bad. Don't watch it. But anyway, well, the big one, and I told you about this, is, well, and we knew this was coming, the night after we recorded last, we went and saw the Barbie movie.
Yeah. I forgot you told me that.
It's real good, y'all. It is real, real good. It is better than I expected. I would say it is better than I hoped. Also, among the six people going to see it, all of us, involved a gentleman about my age who didn't really want to see it, but he was like, okay. And a 13-year-old boy who very much did not want to see it and essentially got dragged to it. And afterwards, all six of us agreed that we liked it, including them. It's even hard to fully explain it. I'm really surprised Mattel signed off on all of it. And Mattel is featured heavily. Obviously, it's a Mattel property, but Mattel is featured heavily. I was like, afterwards, I was like, I don't think this makes me like Mattel better, but it makes me realize Mattel's probably more business savvy than I give them credit for. And Trish is like, no, I just assumed there was a lot more stuff in the script that was much more out there that Mattel axed earlier.
I mean, Mattel's board actually has several women on it, so.
Not in this movie.
I know, not in the movie, but in real life, almost half of the board is women.
Have you seen it?
I haven't yet, no.
Okay. It's very funny. It is upfront about issues of misogyny and things like that.
Right.
It is not perfect by any stretch. It suffers from, I think, still having to sort of be a mainstream movie in a lot of ways. But it is imperfect in ways that have broached a lot of discussion, which I like. So we talk about how good it is, and I'm like, I didn't really like this. And then somebody else will be like, yeah, I guess it was whatever. And I will say it's sort of near when we're sort of finalizing the film, it does what a lot of mainstream movies that try and take a somewhat progressive stance do, where it's like, oh, now we have to sort of diffuse it and water it down so nobody leaves too like offended, you know. So it obviously the movie is a lot about women, and then at a certain point it gets more about gender roles as a whole, and then near the end it gets more about just the state of being a human. And I'm like, you could have just like, you didn't, why do we have to, you had a thing, why did you have to be like, no, this is like, yeah, it wussed out a little bit near the end, but these are small criticisms. I would not have expected a movie like this to be this progressive, to be this feminist, while being good. And I have to be careful with this one. I respect and love him in his ability to act. This might be the best Ryan Gosling performance to date.
I mean, you're not the first person to say that.
Now, the more I have thought about it, what I think it may actually be is this is the least like any other Ryan Gosling performance I have seen. And I have never particularly had the belief that Ryan Gosling has a lot of range. And this is very different. Also, just a fascinating cast. There are so many people in this movie, including, I hadn't realized, America Ferrara in a pretty large part. And has really... I really like her, but I also feel like she's a little bit been typecast since day one. Like, cause she started on Ugly Betty, and then Superstore was one of her big ones. And then she's in movies like this, and she always is basically sort of an aggrieved woman having to navigate the fact that she is not society's ideal, I guess. And she does it real well. She has a monologue in this film that, mark my words, every freaking theater kid is going to be, boys and girls, is going to be using this monologue for their auditions for years to come. Because it's just too good. So yeah, it was a really fun time. Also, just the other day, I actually had been napping and I woke up and my wife is watching the documentary about Robin Williams. That's from like 2016 or something. Hmm. I think it's called Robin Williams, Come in My Mind. Get it? This is a funny joke, whatever. And I didn't watch the whole thing. I came in at the point chronologically where the character of Mork first showed up on the episode of Happy Days. That's mm-hmm. when I, and actually the origin story, that's kind of interesting. And went from there. And it's very interesting. I have always felt a very strong connection to Robin Williams.
Yeah.
In my younger days, I was frequently compared to him because I was the goofy, funny one. And then he sort of got older and I didn't think of myself related to him so much. His career changed and interviews changed and the kind of roles he wanted changed. But he's 26 years older than me. So I eventually hit a point where I got old enough that now I did kind of get it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, and he did that with some stuff I did. He had Parkinson's? I didn't remember or maybe didn't know this. But in later years, it was like he developed Parkinson's.
Coincidentally, I did go home this weekend. My mom's birthday's on the 12th, and we often get together, you know, to celebrate her birthday. Mm-hmm. And he was brought up in our conversation, and we talked about him, you know, committing suicide or whatever. And Dad said, "Oh, but he had." I didn't think it was Parkinson's. Whatever it was,
he had a few things, but he also had Parkinson's apparently.
Yeah, the implication in the conversation was that this was what led to him deciding to take his own life, and I hadn't heard that until then.
There is some implications that his suicide was, and I mean, one could argue this is always the case, but like very deliberately neurochemical based and not like a decision he made.
Oh, interesting.
But it's one of those things that's very hard to ever verify. At least this documentary seemed to sort of imply that. But I learned a lot I didn't know about him. But also, but again, I don't have a lot of the issues he had, but I have some of them. And a lot of the mental health issues that they talked about and people who knew him and talked about, like when he was in public versus private and all that, like still resonate really strongly. It's very strange, but.
I don't know if you remember this, but one of the reasons we were talking about him was I brought up remembering when he was first getting famous. There were articles that came out, I think even more than one, that talked about him having mental health issues. And they even pointed to aspects of his performance that indicated tension and stress. And, you know, even in his, he was on Mork and Mindy at the time. And they said, oh, mm-hmm. when you see him do certain things with his mouth or do some certain things, that's not part of his performance. That's nervous tension. He's going through a lot of stress.
He was always very open about that because yeah. I remember a later time, I think it was around the Dead Poets Society era or whatever. I remember reading an article about how, yeah, if you hung out with him in private, he's just a completely different guy. And that also broached on, like, he has these mental health issues and so he has to sort of turn it on and turn it off and that kind of thing too. And lots of good interview, obviously Pam Dauber's there and other, but like a lot of stuff with Billy Crystal and things like that. It's just very interesting. But also, we watched the 1961 Paul Newman starring The Hustler.
Oh. I think I've seen that, but it was a long time ago.
Probably 1961. I had not. Here's how we got to this. So recently, pop into my head, the movie The Color of Money. I saw it a very long time ago. I remember enjoying it. Had a Paul Newman as an older pool hustler, and he sort of takes under his wing a young and not as famous at the time, but still kind of famous, Tom Cruise as the young up-and-coming hustler. That's literally all I can remember about it, except for Werewolves of London playing while Tom Cruise is playing pool. But I remember liking it, and Paul Newman, the hell, you know, and, you know, young Tom Cruise, all sounds great. Like, we should watch that. Trish has never seen it. I should have Trish watch it. So I said, let's watch it. And she's like, oh, I think I have seen it, but it was a long time ago. I was like, well, me too. Let's watch it. So we're trying to find, we're on the Roku TV trying to figure out where it is. Do we have to pay money for it, et cetera, et cetera. And in the description, it mentions it's a sequel to the 1961 movie, The Hustler. Mm-hmm. And we're both like, it is? Have you seen The Hustler? No, I haven't seen The Hustler. So then we're like, well, maybe we should watch The Hustler first. So we watched The Hustler.
Okay.
Holy shit. Why are we not all talking about The Hustler?
I mean, we did when they made that Tom Cruise movie. Everybody was talking about how it was a sequel and about, you know, wondering if it was going to be worthy to the.
Well, and the movie. the weird thing now is actually near the end. I'm like, I think I remember some of this being referenced in The Color of Money. But yeah. I mean, it is a very long, it's like 30 years between them or whatever. So it only, I mean, it's the same character Paul Newman is playing, but it is a long time away. So the plots don't have a ton to do with each other. But it's an insanely, amazingly well done film. Like, and also it has a bunch of people in it that you, if you're like me, know very differently than you do here. For starters, I suddenly realized I've never really seen young Paul Newman. I mean, I've seen him pictures or whatever. I know what he looked like, but yeah. Like, I've never seen him act when he was the young fucking buck. Like, I've only ever seen Paul Newman as sort of the elder statesman in a movie.
Oh, you mean you didn't see him like, you didn't see like Cool Hand Luke or.
I didn't see Cool Hand Luke. I haven't seen The Sting.
None of that. Or Butch and Sundance. You haven't seen that?
No, I haven't seen Butch and Sundance either. But even those are sort of later. We looked it up, and this is the movie that made Paul Newman. He had been in like two movies before this, and it wasn't as leads.
I mean, I guess that's right, yeah.
His thing.
Yeah.
Also, Piper Laurie, who I know, but I don't know well, who is unbelievable in this movie.
Also, I mean, Jackie Gleason's in it, right? And he was sort of wanted for his
Gleason
performance.
Is in this movie.
Minnesota Fats he plays, I think.
Yes! Who, by the way, up until this movie, Trish and I both thought Minnesota Fats was an actual historical figure, but is a made-up figure for The Hustler, and it's Jackie Gleason, who I literally have never seen perform in anything except The Honeymooners, in a completely different role that's honestly a sort of small side role in this movie, but he has like even I told Trish after it finished, I'm like, I know we just looked up that's a fake guy, but he is so embodying that character that part of me is still like, are you sure? Because it seems like he's really channeling a real person. But apparently, I mean, no.
Minnesota Fats was a real guy. I used to watch him play pool on TV.
All right. Well, the two people I trust most in the world have both told me mutually exclusive data. So I don't know what to do at this point. I'm sitting here just believing what people tell me. I thought Minnesota Fats was a real person. My wife, while we were watching that movie, looked up on her phone and said, no, actually, he's a character that was created for this movie. And now you are telling me, no, he's a real person. I met him once or something.
But I don't know where the Minnesota Fats I saw playing pool on TV got that name. I mean, for all I know, he's
named after the character from The Hustler.
Yeah, he.
But Jack Gleason, also amazing. Also, there's a character near the end that I freaked out because I thought it was Hal Holbrook, and it wasn't Hal Holbrook, but you know who it was? And he was playing the southern dandy of a rich man who just likes to play hustlers at billiards and stuff like this. It was the freaking mayor from Jaws, but like way young. But the most amazing thing in this movie George C. Scott.
Mm-hmm.
George C. Scott giving a performance unlike anything I have ever seen in my life, and making me realize, while I have seen quite a few George C. Scott films, they were all much later in his career. I have not seen a lot of early George C. Scott, and I really want to now, because it was amazing. And again, it's one of those very thought-provoking movies. There is a lot of misogyny in this film, for all that there's literally one female character. But some of it is very intentional, like, and it's supposed to be horrific misogyny stuff. Some of it, I think, is the time period in which it was made. But it's kind of like Piper Laurie's character is incredibly three-dimensional and is so, it is as nuanced and detailed as Paul Newman's character, if not more so. She could arguably be the most realized character in the film. And I noted it because there is a certain scene in which she is not present and other people are talking about her, and they are talking about her personality and things like that. And I remember they would say, like, oh, she's the kind of person who's like this or whatever. And I would be like, yeah, she really is. Because after 2 hours, I had understood enough of a character that I was like, yeah, that's accurate.
Hmm.
And it's why I also have a lot of the ending of this movie. I do not understand. I have witnessed and participated in a lot of conversations on the internet about film in various different capacities, themes, motif, types of whatever's, actors, da, 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 da. I have never heard anyone in any of these discussions mention the end of The Hustler, and I do not understand why. It is an absolute kick to the head of an ending, in my opinion. And it is one that I have been pondering for days, and I still don't entirely know how I feel about it. How does this not come up in more conversations about film? This movie is amazing. You could do a semester class picking this movie apart.
Oh, I'm sure.
Also, from a film perspective, it's gorgeous. It's filmed impeccably. The shots are lined up in such amazing ways. Apparently, the director is just a hard ass in terms of his vision. I forget what other stuff he's done, but he basically makes movies that have a point, and he's gonna make it whether you like the point or not. Like, he is an auteur in a very, and not like he's hard to work with or anything, but like this, in some ways, I think this is a surprisingly feminist movie in a lot of ways. And in other ways, it's very much not. But all accounts are that this is very deliberate on the part of the director. I wish I could remember the other stuff that he's made, but because Trish knows him and she was talking about some of the other ones. It's amazing.
We used to watch Pool on television. We went to Des Moines once to watch Willie Moscone play. And he was sort of the arch nemesis of Minnesota Fats. Again, the guy that I knew as Minnesota Fats, like, and I watched television, that's what he was called. He very well could have gotten that name from the movie. I mean, because 1961, he very well could have gotten it from the movie. So, like you said, it was made up for the movie. And then since he was this guy that they called Minnesota Fats was a big guy and a pool player. And I think he just kind of got that name probably. But yeah, he was on television playing pool. Dad used to watch pool and bowling and all that stuff. And we watched that stuff. And again, Willie Moscone was in Des Moines once, and we went to watch him at a store that sold pool tables, but I never did see Minnesota Fats in person.
Just so everybody knows, movie's not really much about hustling pool.
Hmm.
So don't get super excited if that's why you want to watch something like this, but it's really, and this is a thing I'm discovering as I get older. There's a part of my brain that thinks acting is not great in a lot of older movies. And I think I've always rationalized this as somehow like what people were going for. in the same way that I can now see Bollywood and Tollywood movies, acting is different in those movies than in Western movies. And I can see that, and I can be aware that it's not this one's better, this one's not. They're going for different things. Like, the point of the performance is different. And I think in my head, I always thought that about older movies past a certain point. But also back then, I always thought that they just weren't as good yet. Like, acting hadn't evolved to what it is. Watch this. Absolutely fucking not.
Well, the
unbelievable bits, sometimes with no lines, sometimes with virtually no movement and no lines.
Right. Well, you have to understand. So
much conveyed. It's unbelievable.
When film and television was first getting started, people did stage performance, and that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, whole different thing.
So now you've got people, they had to realize through silent films, like silent films taught people that there was such a thing as a close-up, that sometimes you put a whole shot was just the person, you know, making a big emotional thing. And you might do that on stage sometimes, but also film was edited, right? So you were making the pieces and putting it together, not like a stage performance where it's all one continuous thing. So making films and doing stage thing was very different, and that had to evolve.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you had to get the actors who were coming from silent film or coming from the stage didn't translate very well to the film, which was very different.
There's a classic thing nowadays of musical theater versus non-musical theater versus movies versus TV. All of them, you have to adjust slightly.
But yeah, a little
bit. This also has levels in it. Like, there's a point in this film in which one major character whispers something to another character, like to another main character. We never find out what that was. It's never referenced, or it causes a lot of reaction. And actually, it caused me to assume some things about how things would end that didn't happen. But now I'm just like, in light of what did happen, what did that person say to that other person? And I'll never know, but it worked really well for that. Also, tiny side note, but I just thought this was fun. There's a scene early on, and this guy shows up and he's talking to Paul Newman's character. And I'm like, Trish and I do this a lot nowadays. We'll be watching something and we're like, that is somebody. By which we just mean that's an actor that we know. But frequently we can't place it. We're just like, that's somebody. And I was sitting there, I was like, that's somebody. And Trish isn't really paying attention to me because apparently it's not drawing Abe Vigoda. And I'm watching, I'm like, who's he's not? And my brain keeps wanting to go Abe Vigoda. I'm like, it's definitely not Abe Vigoda. But I'm like, maybe it's another one of those like guys in the back of The Godfather. There are a whole bunch of actors that you don't know. Their first major thing was as like a small part in The Godfather. Abe Vigoda, Paul Sorvino, whole bunch of guys. Anyway, so I'm like, is it that? No. And then I'm like, screw it. I have to get on IMDb and look it up. And as I'm typing it in, I'm looking at the screen. And then I'm like, and keep in mind, this is from 1961 in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, is that the dad from My Big Fat Greek Wedding? And guess what? It was the fucking dad from My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Well, I don't even remember that guy.
Right? Of course not. If you had asked me to picture the dad from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, blank. Absolute blank. Although you should appreciate it because it's a Greek man named Gus.
Oh, Gus.
But
of course, that's his name.
I would not remotely have remembered him.
Mm.
And so I was really tickled that I could tell, and also weirded out that in the course of like 40 years, he basically looks the same, but also different, like goes without saying. Totally different character, totally different voice, totally different accent. And the scene in question, which gets referenced a lot throughout the movie, takes place in, they don't specify that it's Iowa, but it's the middle of the country and it's Ames. So well, I feel like
probably Iowa, yeah.
Right?
Huh.
And it not only does a major scene, the actually several scenes, but a major set piece happens in Ames. We later reference several times, like, I remember back in Ames. Like, yeah, so Ames is big.
I don't remember that.
Give me Azertown's bullshit. We're running late, but I feel bad that I didn't answer it otherwise. So, because I had so much to say about kind of everything.
The subject line just says tarot.
Like tarot root or like tarot cards?
Cards. T-A-R-O-T.
Tarot.
And he says, there is no greeting. Although maybe that is a greeting, so that seems, maybe that's an ironic.
Anyhow, I'm not going to sleep tonight pondering that question.
I'd like to know if I can make a side hustle doing tarot readings.
What? You just reminded me. Classic Simpsons. Lisa becomes a beauty queen or whatever, and they don't like her, and so they want to boot her out, and they figure out how to do it because Homer filled out the application wrong, because in the section marked do not write in this section, he wrote okay. So there is no greeting. Makes me think the same thing. Oh, really? Well, then what was that? Sorry, go ahead.
He says, I'd like to know if I can make a side hustle doing tarot readings online. Each of you, please give me something on your mind you would like the cards to help you clarify. I will send the results as an email once I have heard them. The great and powerful Azure Talon, mistress of 2:20 a.m. to 3:05
a.m. Don't get that last bit.
I don't either.
You can't do a side hustle in tarot readings because you didn't discuss charging at all. And as far as I know, nobody does side hustles for free. It goes against the very concept of hustling.
Well, unless we give him our question and he says, I'll tell you the answer if you pay me $3.50. And then we'll say, you're not Azure Talon. You're the Loch Ness Monster.
It was fun. I was sitting next to the 15-year-old when we were watching the Barbie movie. So we would occasionally have things. And there's one point they do this joke thing where they're like throwing clothes out the window and it's all Barbie clothes. And they all like suddenly like unfold and appear. And there's a little thing like describing what outfit it was or whatever as a joke. And there was one at one point, and I just lean over to him and I'm like, you would rock the shit out of those palazzo pants. And then later there was a thing where they had a different article clothing. And I was like, I'll bet you they're actually going to market that in real life. And I'm thinking about getting one. And he's like, oh yeah, you would slay in that. But what's also fun is there was a trailer at the beginning of Barbie. There were a lot of trailers, but one of them was for Illumination Studios, their latest animated thing. I forget what it's called. It's about some ducks that decide they're going to try flying south for the winter and fuck it up and end up in, I think, New York in a big city and hijinks ensue. We're watching the trailer. On the other side is Trish. And I'm listening, and the dad duck, his voice is familiar. And I turned to Trish at the same time. She turned to me like, is that Kumail? Oh. And it was. It's Kumail Nanjiani, plays the main guy. And so then we're watching it. And so then I just lean over to the other side where the teenager is at one point, and the dad duck's on the screen doing something. And I was like, I went to college with that duck. But you have to understand, these are my nibblings. And so they are used to my bullshit. Didn't even phase it. He's like, oh, like, because I'm full of lies. But then I said, well, the voice actor, at which point he realized I was talking seriously. And he's like, oh, really? So when it was me just claiming I went to school with that duck.
With a duck.
Fine. But yeah, that duck's voice actor. Oh. Anyway. I don't want to address this at all, but I want to use this as a springboard. Talk to me. Oh my God, I sound like my father. In 25 words or less. Sorry, that's a joke for Trish, who doesn't listen to this podcast. Talk to me about your feelings about people who do psychic readings, divinations, things like that. For money. How do you feel about that practice? ethically, I guess.
Oh, ethically, you're asking.
I guess. I guess that's what I'm asking. I mean, if you have feelings unrelated to the ethical implications, feel free to share them. But
well, I do believe I've been acquainted with people who do it, who I'm pretty sure believe in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me if you believe in this and you think you're really giving people insight, you know, really helping them, and if you think you're good at it, and if someone's willing to pay you for it, I don't feel like I am in a position to object to it ethically. Now, of course, there are people who are charlatans, right? Who lie about, especially people who say they can talk to your dead relatives and stuff. Boy, that really, I do not like that at all.
Well,
but there are people who believe that they can do it. I mean, they're not, they don't think they're faking it.
Yeah.
And other people believe them. And it's like, I don't know. I don't feel like there's grounds for me to be critical of that, but there are people who do lie. And, you know, so someone could ask, well, what's really the difference from the standpoint of the person who's paying for these services, if they're not really getting the services that they're paying for, why should it matter if the person giving them believes they are or not? Well, I think that does count in the calculus of ethics, the intentions.
Well,
and stuff.
But it also, well, not also becomes, because there is no definitive consensus on whether or not such an ability exists. Right. It's the equivalent of saying, hey, William, I'm going to sell you this DVD of a good movie for $10. If I believe it's a good movie and I sell it to you and you're like, yeah, it's a good movie,
you're thinking
nothing wrong with that. Yeah. If I think it's a shitty movie and I'm trying to unload it on you, then it very much is a different thing, even if you feel exactly the same about it.
Yes, exactly. That's right. But, I think so too.
All right. So I think I agree with all of that. But I want to throw something in the mix here. We'll set aside people who genuinely think they have psychic abilities. Okay. Although I think within that there is an argument, and I have known certain spiritual traditions that believed in that sort of thing and actually believed it was really ethically inappropriate to charge for that.
Yes, that's right. I've been familiar with that too.
But I can also very easily see arguments in that. And there's arguments for a lot of things like that. Should you charge for this? Should you charge for that?
I'm going to get paid to be a therapist. I'm getting paid to help people with their mental issues. I mean,
but I don't think that's a useful argument to have just on the subject of divination, nor is it one that we can possibly tackle at the moment. But I do want to throw this one to you. So I'm a diviner. I'm a psychic. I'm a Long Island medium. Which is a medium with three different kinds of liquor in it. But it just kind of tastes like cola. It's great. Gets you real fucked up. I know I'm not. I'm being sneaky and I'm charging money for it. And you're like, Tony, I know you. You don't believe in this. You're charging money. What the fuck? And I say to you, I am charging for a legitimate service I give, which is to give these people a sense of hope and a sense of closure. I don't tell them, you know, how to spend their money, how to invest their money or what job to take or whatever. I tell them that their dad is in heaven now and is very proud of them, or that they're at peace or whatever. And that is something that helps them. Not unlike you and your vaunted therapy, William. Right. So, mean, how do you feel about that argument?
Okay.
For the sake of this, if it helps, pretend somebody less smarmy and awful than me is the one making the argument to you.
The fact of the matter is, I do see my profession as being the successor of things very much like what you're talking about. I mean, history is full of people that, you know, we look back and call, you know, shamans, witch doctors, whatever you like. And many times some of those people would just tell people whatever they wanted to hear. And they get paid. It was
or whatever, like, they thought would be useful. If we want to be really charitable, they thought would help.
Yeah. Of course, and I'm not saying that people in past generations who thought they had powers didn't believe it, but even some of those people knew that sometimes it wasn't about power. Sometimes you just said, oh, if you go out into battle today, you're going to be successful. They didn't really know. But they knew that if the person went out confidently, that was going to improve their chances. And if they were dead,
they were successful, they probably couldn't come back and complain.
Exactly. They couldn't complain if they were killed. But if they came back, they could celebrate this person. You know, that kind of thing happened. Is it bad? Is that bad to help give a person confidence and in positive feelings while they're possibly going to their death? Or, as you were pointing out, to tell someone, hey, your father's in heaven and they're proud of you, and that person has a better opinion of themselves and can live a better life after that? In other words, do the ends justify the means in these cases? And, you know, obviously, even though I think my profession is the spiritual successor of some of these things, of course, the ethics of my profession would prohibit things like that. But that's just the culture we live in now. That doesn't make it right or wrong.
For start, I mean, that's the big one. I assume you would never lie to a patient. Or right. Maybe, would you? Are there schools of therapy where we do that?
There are therapists who have done that. I mean, famous ones.
Well, I mean, yeah. There are therapists who have done a lot of stuff that even on this podcast, I'm not willing to talk about.
I mean, when I famous ones who did it as part of therapy, and they're like in their own books, they'd write about the case. And, well, I said this because I knew that the person would do this. I don't think anyone today thinks that that's even some of them don't think that that was a smart way to go or a good thing to do. Yeah. So yes, lying in general, even lying in a way, like, let's say you're dealing with a delusional person. There's some debate about whether or not it might be therapeutic to at least in that moment sort of slip into their delusion to kind of meet them where they are and maybe pull them back. But I think the general consensus is you don't do that. You don't.
Well, in my personal experience as somebody with delusions who has gone to therapy, you don't have to.
No, right.
You
That's
can
right.
Like, because I would assert a lot of things about myself to my therapist. And when she was talking in reference to that, she would say, it's very clear that you feel like this, that you feel whatever it is you just said. And in that case, she was acknowledging and she was going with it. We were talking about it, but at no point was she specifying whether or not she believed it.
But I mean, even a thing like you've got to. Client or a patient that's seeing that someone's in the room, they're saying, do you see that person over there? You know, you're not supposed to say, oh yeah, that person right over there.
Yeah.
You're supposed to say, well, no, I don't see that person, but you
then
can
you
tell
go
me
with
about
like,
that person.
But you do. So yeah, let's talk,
yeah, let's
about,
talk about that. Right. But I mean, there are therapists who have written about, maybe they're working in a institution and someone's talking about being, they think they're Abraham Lincoln, and the therapist will just go with that, just to kind of get an idea of what the full scope of their delusion is, in hopes that they will find kind of why they have that delusion. And I understand that approach, but again, by professional standards today, you wouldn't do it like that. But like you just said, I don't think you have to. I think what therapists have realized is you don't really have to do that to get to the information you're looking for. So just don't do it. But to answer your question, because we're kind of going around and around in circles here, because I think that person, whoever they are, can be helped in a less deceptive way, right? Because that's part of it. I mean, I see the ethical argument that's being put forth here. But it kind of presumes that this person can't find relief from this thing without having some kind of delusional belief or without being lied to or whatever.
Yeah.
And since I don't believe that's true, since I believe there are other ways that this can happen, I see what's happening more as a way to line your own pockets than to really help this person.
Well, which is where I end up. And this may be another one of those things where you and I have the same opinions about things, but coming from different perspectives. To me, it's about intent, and that's not something I can verify. But in a purely hypothetical ethical argument, if I, the psychic, am like, I'm giving hope to this person, I'm giving peace to this person, is that ethical? To me, if I'm doing it in order to give them hope and peace, and I happen to be charging because my time is spent doing this kind of thing, and this is how I need to earn my living, but I don't gouge them or anything, that's arguably ethical. I think an argument could be made there are better ways to do it, but ethically speaking, I don't really have a problem with the concept. If I am doing it and doing it because I can get a lot of money off of naive rich people, again, if in these two situations we assume the result for the target, the end result, the level of hope or peace is equal, the situations are not equal ethically to me. It's a good faith versus bad faith argument. If you are in good faith trying to help someone, great. If you are trying to bilk someone out of money and out of desperation say, but also it seems to be helping them, even if that's true, you still shit.
That's sure. Like you go. There's a lot of very fine lines there, right?
Well, and it's wholly subjective. Well, it's wholly subjective, full stop. But also, we can't gauge the motivations of
whoever. But also, again, consider, as I was saying, you can go back and you can find accounts of people in certain cultural contexts who are doing this. I mean, who will admit, well, yeah, I do magical stuff, but that wasn't magical. I just said that because that was going to help that person, or I just said that because that was going to do whatever. So then you have to ask yourself, well, is it ethical in that cultural context? I mean, who can say, right? I can't judge that cultural context or whatever.
Yeah, and then we get into coercion and force and all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Like, you know, in a way you can, because think of it in terms of a priest who is hearing someone's confession and who has them go through this something to absolve them of their sin. Now, that person's not going to, you know, flip a quarter to the priest in that case, but that person is presumably a parishioner who puts something in the plate, you know, right? I mean, that priest makes a living doing that.
I'm just super caught up in if the clergy accepted tips. I love that image.
What I'm saying is that this person is doing this.
20% is customary. 10% tithe, 20% gratuity.
This person is making their living telling people that if they do these things, their sins are forgiven and they're going to get into heaven. Is that not the same thing? Except they believe it, of course, right? The priests, well, maybe some of them don't.
Well, no, I think there is an argument of divination to that. And as actually, it's really funny. I don't want to spoil things for you, but we are in the process of watching season 3 of Righteous Gemstones about the televangelist family. And actually, we watched an episode last night in which a situation arose that begs this exact question. And I won't spoil what it is. But yeah, this exact thing is what happened is what happened. What were your motivations? What were your beliefs? Drastically changed the ethical nature of what happened. Were you going for? And actually made the show asked the question and then answered it in a really weird way that was totally Trish and I both agree, whatever happens with the show, this might be our last season of Righteous Gemstones. We have really enjoyed it, but it's hitting a point where I'm like, I think I've gotten everything I can out of this show. But yeah. All right. Anyway, to briefly go back to Azure Town, I have a question for the cards. I don't want to go on too much length about this. In my life recently, I have fairly deliberately, heavily, heavily curtailed my social life and my socializing with people. I have gone through a lot of debate in my own head about whether that is the wisest course of action or not for me. So, yeah, what do the cards say about that? I am paying you shit, for the record. So if that's a deal breaker, you don't got to do it. But
what I have a question in mind, but I'm not sure I want to ask it.
Send it to him.
Think that psychically?
Yeah.
Psychically send it to him.
I used to read tarot cards a lot.
It just relates to this whole project I'm doing with, you know, school and all that. I think if I asked it, it would be,
you definitely shouldn't become a therapist. I can cover you that.
No,
right
that
now.
Wouldn't be
the cards. The question that,
if I was going to ask the question, it would be, I would want to know one of three things that may result from me going into this. Will I regret it? Will I not regret it? Or will I be really, really glad I did it? Which one of those three things is going to be the case? I'm curious to know. Not that he can tell me, but that is something I'm curious about.
A bit reductivist. I think, statistically speaking, the most likely one is you'll kind of regret it, kind of not regret it. That's how I find most major life decisions are for me.
Oh, well, I have no idea.
I should rephrase. There will be pros, there will be cons.
Sure, sure.
As a gentleman who is unwilling to ever deal in hypotheticals, I do not think you will ever be willing, even to yourself, to actually weigh that out and decide which one wins.
You're probably right. But I have had things that...
This is why you don't play Fuck, Marry, Kill.
I know, but listen, there have been things I have unequivocally regretted, but you're probably right. There's not anything I've unequivocally thought was great. Yeah, I always had a little bit of, that shouldn't, you know, you're right. That's right.
Unless it is extreme enough. I mean, there are definitely things.
Maybe this is a new experience for me.
I bet you're willing to say it was definitely a good call to end up with your wife.
Yeah, there's no ambiguity there for sure.
See, and it's not that it's perfect. It's not that there aren't downsides to it, but yeah,
there are
things. So you're right. If you really, really, really are pleased that you did it, I guess that does count. But I feel like the world in between. I really want to get on this Fuck, Marry, Kill thing in the future. We'll have to get back to this. I know you hate it because it has that word in it, but this is the thing. It is a construct for a hypothetical consideration that doesn't have to involve anything involving sex or death, and doesn't even have to involve people, that I think is a very interesting thing to play with, but we should talk about it another time. Because I've seen people do Fuck, Marry, Kill with abstract concepts, and that was what made me realize things after that. Yeah, it's a deal, but we'll talk about it another time. If you want to play Fuck, Marry, Kill, I mean, just go do it. I don't give a shit. Whatever. If you have feelings about how unethical Azure Talon is for charging us to read tarot cards on the internet, which means he's not even doing it. He's making shit up. He's playing a little game of MASH by himself and then decide, I don't know. Go to the blog, magicaltalkinghat.com. Or if you're on YouTube, comment on YouTube. And tell us your thoughts on that. I do want everybody to tell me if they know the game MASH. I am just curious how that proliferated. Also, please write in themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com with anything that you want. Don't feel scared. It's just email. It's fine. And also, it'll be a week and a half for us, but for you, it'll be a week. Listen again next week. Um And just remember, I had a sign off for this that I forgot.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.